Welcome to another episode of Money for Nothing, the podcast about music and capitalism. I'm Saxon Baird with Sam Backer as always. Sam, I know you must be excited to hear that Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, after over 2 years of not being on Spotify, have returned. Yes, they're back on the streaming platform. If you have not been paying attention for the last couple of years and for some reason listen to this podcast, we'll refresh you that in January of 2022, artists like Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and also other artists like Nils Lofgren of E Street Band and Graham Nash decided to pull their music from Spotify shortly after the music streaming platform decided to ink an exclusive deal with Joe Rogan's podcast. They were concerned with the way that Rogan had spread vaccine misinformation. First, Young pulled his music, and then Mitchell and others followed. And it's also fair to mention that shortly after, Rogan did apologize and did say that he was trying.
He was just asking questions. That's American, man.
But he did say, I don't always get it right. But we're not here to talk about the controversy around.
If Joe Rogan was just like, I always get it right.
No, he said, I don't always get it right.
When we're like, we know, Joe. Like,
yeah, no shit. Yeah,
no
yeah.
part but, of you know, your value proposition is that you always get it right. Like, it's bad enough as is, but like, just imagining a world where Joe Rogan's like, I'm the expert on literally everything.
Well, but you know, even though we're not here to talk about Joe Rogan, though, although I will say that my friend bartends in Austin and says that every time Joe comes in, he not only tips 100% but buys the entire bar around. So, you know, for me, regardless of your politics, if you tip well, you're good in my book. But
it's not funny.
I've never listened to it, actually.
Here's the thing, dude. I tried.
Is it supposed to be? I guess he is. He's a comedian, huh?
You know, he's a comedian. I tried once when it was first like blowing up out of the like. When it was becoming the nation's biggest podcast in like, I don't know, 2018, I tried it and I was like, I really can't. It's really, really bad. That's the thing.
You're
it's
also. Like,
I know. I'm branding myself as an effete East Coast liberal, but like, it wasn't the politics. It was the like. Poor quality of like the thing.
Yeah. I'm beginning
to whoa, I can't believe people listen to this.
This will not surprise anybody who listens to this podcast, but I'm beginning to like fully realize and fully come to terms and embrace the fact that I live in an extreme bubble that tends to be full of very well-read academic urban type of people. And that maybe
you can just call us Jews, Zach.
And on that note, we are going to not talk about Joe Rogan, but we did feel that this was interesting for a number of reasons. Oh yeah, to be clear, at the top of the show, I did say Mitchell and Young are back now, ironically happening around the same time that Spotify has just inked another deal with Rogan. However, this time Rogan's podcast is not exclusive to Spotify. Rather, Spotify will host, handle the ad sales, and distribute the podcast. But yeah, we felt it was a good news clip to briefly chat about this, not so much because of the Rogan debate, but for other interesting aspects. For instance, noting that the dominance of platforms and listening to music, and maybe also to remind people that actually Neil Young didn't actually have the right to pull his music, and he actually had to work through his label, which is another interesting aspect that an artist even of Young stature still has to jump through or get past a number of contractual obstacles to really even make a decision like this. Yeah, and then most artists really don't have the legal right to remove their music from a streaming platform, and I think that's kind of where we're going to start this conversation.
Yeah, no, so I mean, I think one thing that's important to say, like maybe this framing is, you said it's kind of ironic that Young put his music back on Spotify at the same time that Rogan inked this new deal, and in fact, I mean, it's directly causal, right? It's that Rogan was Spotify exclusive. Which was a result of this big Spotify push into podcasting that from about two, three years, when they were throwing huge money into the podcasting ecosystem, which is why, of course, our podcast is sponsored by Spotify. Saxon and I's lavish mink-filled rooms are entirely paid for by stealing money from, you know, the ill-gotten gains from paying fractions of a penny to most musicians. Yeah, so that this was a huge push into the podcasting system, which I think we could debate about, and we've talked about a lot, whether or not this made sense. I think at some level, it probably did, as a gamble, in as much as Spotify was trying desperately to like differentiate itself from the other streaming services. Regardless, it didn't work, and so there is a new deal with Rogan, and Spotify is going to be distributing Rogan, but now Rogan is no longer going to be exclusively on Spotify. And as Joe Rogan's podcast was now going to be available everywhere, Young was faced with either continuing just to like flip off Spotify, despite the fact that there was now no longer any differentiation, right? Like his music was going to appear next to Rogan on all the other streaming services. Or, I mean, not next to it, unless like someone has a really trolly like Joe Rogan and Chrome Dreams 2 playlist. It's just episodes of Joe Rogan's podcast followed by Neil Young's songs that are directly related to them. But in the general streaming platform, so either he would have to pull all of his music from everywhere, or he would just continue to keep off Spotify for no particularly good reason. And being both a dedicated iconoclast and a savvy businessman, he was like, fine, there's no longer any differentiation. However, he says, Spotify is still the worst sounding streaming service. So you really shouldn't, you can listen to my music there, but you really shouldn't.
Which is a huge issue with Young that dates back like well over a decade at this point.
Oh, I mean, dude, the Neil, first off, so I did some because I actually am a medium-sized Neil Young fan.
I would even that, like argue that maybe you're not even medium-sized. I mean, like, I don't really know anybody who listens to his new music that's like under the age of like 60, and you definitely do and send me tracks all the time.
Okay, so that's a different okay. thing. So I do think that Neil Young is the last 60s artist standing, and in fact is the only artist from that era who got better over time. I think that peak Neil Young is 90s Neil Young. It's pretty much exclusively
take that,
crazy
boomers.
And it's when they get it's when they get the really big orange amps and it's just tones for days. And Neil Young has continued, you know, to have this kind of iconoclastic path through audio quality. So he has been fighting MP3s and fighting for the real and fighting for that analog tone since the beginning of digital music. Basically, he, right, I don't know if anyone remembers this, in the early 2010s he actually crowdfunded his own music player,
Pono. Baby.
which so this is like, I'm just gonna read you, like, I got to dig into Neil Young for this, and it was so fun. Have you been to Neil Young's website, Saxon?
Yeah, I did. I was actually quite impressed with the way that it was like a web 1.0, like literally like newspaper-looking like, homepage landing, like literally with columns and everything. Like it's,
you
yeah,
have
well,
to
I should,
check
I should
it
link
out.
To it.
It's so good. It's so good. It's just like constantly being updated. It really looks like a web 1.0 page.
It vibes constantly so heavily GeoCities.
I know. So this is I'm gonna read very briefly from Neil Young, and this has got nothing to do with this is a Neil Young blog post unrelated to the Spotify system, but Spotify debate, but connected to his deep and full-throated rejection of digital music. So he they're recently remastering Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young concert from tapes. Sure, you will get it in digital, but you can feel it in analog. That's a real thing. That's what I think music is, a feeling. Paragraph break. Imagine you look through a window. Paragraph break. It's beautifully real out there. Paragraph break. Someone puts a screen in the window. Paragraph break. Digital. Paragraph break. You look through all the holes in the screen. Paragraph break. You see what you saw before. Paragraph break. The screens are small. Parenthetical. Smallest in high res. End parentheses. Paragraph break. You come up to a screen hole and take a look. Paragraph break. You look at the sky. Paragraph break. The dominant color of the blue sky. Now everything is blue in your screen hole. Exactly the same blue. Welcome to the digital age. You lost the universe.
Oh my God, it's so heavy and awesome.
and he does in this.
Well, hey, wait. Let me ask you.
Wait, like, really quickly. In the Spotify, the announcement, he says, and our new album will be released on Spotify, so you can listen to all the music except for the sounds we made.
Damn. Well, so let me ask you: has he ever written because you actually listened to like late career Neil Young and like his new stuff? Like, has he actually ever like written about this?
Yeah.
His lyrics?
Oh, extensively.
Oh my God, amazing.
In fact, the entire framing of his 2012 opus, Looking Back, from the album Psychedelic Pill, a double album, incredible. Looking Back, a 24-minute track, opens with him strumming over acoustic guitars and being like, I'm worried about music. I'm worried about how people listen. I'm worried that they can't really hear my songs. I think back to when they could.
Wow.
No, he writes Neil Young, a man of not that many lyrical themes.
Yeah, facts.
You really think he hasn't written extensively about his dislike of MP3s in his music? You are wrong, sir.
but did he ever write about how he tried to get funding for Pono from Donald Trump in 2015? Another totally weird, like the universe in which like Donald Trump and Neil Young like make a business deal, like, yeah, that would have been really strange. And then Donald Trump becomes president. Very odd. But I think his overall point, bringing it back to money for nothing related topics, is the dominance of these streaming platforms, and that he really can't, whether it's in protest of misinformation being spread by like a podcast that's exclusive to Spotify, or it's the sort of crap sound of streaming in which you've illustrated that he despises, the overall point here is that like he can't escape it. And that's actually, I don't have the quote in front of me, but actually when he did actually release a quote explaining like his return to Spotify, and basically to sum it up, it read that like he would either have to take all of his music off all of the platforms,
right,
and then it'd be really hard for a lot of his listeners to hear his new music, or he basically did it for his listeners essentially and his fans, because I think he's realizing it's like it's basically a fight that he like can't win. And I mean, we'll illustrate in the second half how like UMG is solidifying that on when we cover another topic. But like, yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of like the sort of the big picture point of like Neil's issues, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think that like to his frustration, and it's really interesting the extent to which like Neil Young as Canadian Don Quixote has like failed to slay the dragon of poor audio quality. Because like I think at a fundamental level, people don't care, or at least like the large group of music listeners don't really care about audio quality, because right, both Apple and Tidal now have better audio quality, and Tidal's like high fidelity audio quality is now actually they collapsed it. There used to be a high fidelity tier for streaming and then a low fidelity tier for streaming, and they actually collapsed them both into the low fidelity tier price. And like there has not been, and yet despite the fact that there are from an audio quality perspective real differences between these platforms, like we still talk, you and I, but I think just generally as a cultural conversation, there is we talk about these as like a total lack of differentiation. And in fact, would argue that like Spotify's stranglehold, just because of like first mover advantage stuff, the fact that everyone has all their playlists on Spotify, and mixed with like the medium solid AI predictions that they have, their ability to suggest music, has kept people there, despite the fact that there's a real audio difference. And I mean, you know, not to take like the anecdote as evidence, but like I know precisely zero people and have heard no one who I know one person who had a Tidal subscription because of higher audio quality. I know no one in their day-to-day life who are making these decisions based on audio quality. At the same time as everyone has like $400 noise canceling Beat headphones.
Yeah, I mean that's like a great point. Yeah, I mean, and I guess like that's kind of reflective of also like maybe where we're at when it comes to something that we talked about in our last episode about the accessibility of music. And we were talking about the bill put forth by Rashid Tlaib and Jamal Bowman that was, you know, the restructuring of like how to like pay out artists and royalties and everything. And I think that, you know, one thing that you brought up was really like the value of music, the actual like, you know, economic value, material value of music. And like, I think that it does bring up kind of this issue in the sense where I guess in a sense that if nobody cares about the all audio quality, like, would you consider that? I mean, that's almost like kind of a pushback against this idea that like maybe we're not valuing music enough, and then maybe the value of music has really dropped like to such like this level where it's just expected to be relatively cheap, free, endlessly accessible, and like the quality we don't give a fuck about. Which is interesting to me because I wonder if like just a side note, I want you to respond to that, but I also just want to add like one thing. Like I wonder if like the same could be said about like video quality as well when it comes to like things. People just don't care anymore. But anyways, yeah, let's stick with like the music.
Oh, I mean video quality, I don't know. I mean I'm not a visual person, which is like sounds like a bullshit thing to say, but I just like, you know, it doesn't mean like I can't take a good photograph to save my life, I think.
Well, and so, yeah, like, I mean, I was just saying, like, people are buying, like, 86-inch, you know, TV screens for, and, like, you know, everybody's, like, obsessing over, like, whatever, like, 19K or whatever they're shooting in now. But,
but they also all watch everything on their phones.
Yeah, which is, yeah.
That, I think yeah. Convenience is clearly, I mean, or that there's splits and that it's important to think about kind of media environments as fundamentally variegated, yeah. Right? That there's no one media sure. environment, and that there's, A, going to be different people engaging in different right. ways, and also, if you think about from like a human symbolic level, like people are going to engage with music. They're going to engage with music in different ways or with culture in different ways in different spaces.
Right.
So like people that there's not necessarily a contradiction between people watching a movie in an IMAX versus a different movie, another superhero movie months later with earbuds on a small, you know, on their iPhone on the subway. Though, I mean, even with IMAX movies, I think we've all, you know, different. It's funny how those connect. I mean, I think that like those movies are now too loud in a fundamental way often.
Yeah,
and it makes me sound old as shit, but like they're too loud. Yeah. And like, that's partially because you want right. to really feel it when you're in the theater and like, because you're paying a bunch of money right. for that. And so, but just having a whole bunch of different media experiences all at once. And that it's clearly in some of those spaces, people don't care about quality. I think that maybe.
Go back to my point that it's interesting because it is reflective, I think, of like the how people value music now. Or would you push back against that?
I mean, I think that yes and no, right? Like, I think that people are clearly willing to spend. I kind of, based on this convo, I was like, shit, I should really see Neil Young and Crazy Horse. They're going on tour this summer. I might drive to Philadelphia and see them live on Mother's Day because they're lawn tickets. But in Forest Hills, not the biggest stadium.
My apologies to Mrs. Backer.
Ehrlich. Anyway.
Okay.
Forest Hills, right? That resale, totally sold out. Tickets, the cheapest tickets are $400. So people are willing to spend real money on music. Think about, you know, the Taylor Swift stuff. It's just like where and how they're willing to spend money on music. And that's, I think, more about detaching like commoditized music and music and thinking about those as separate things, I think is a useful way to think through that problem. Because clearly people are willing to spend a lot of money on music in certain ways, but that money doesn't necessarily go to all the artists, and that and doesn't necessarily flow through the ecosystem in effective ways. Like, UMG is doing fine. I mean, I think also with Neil Young, and this might just reflect questions about fandom that I think we're going to get into more in the second half of this episode. But, I mean, so one of the fun things, again, about all of Neil Young's stuff being back on Spotify is that he's got this he's unbelievably prolific, right? And has been throughout his whole career in a kind of almost Prince-esque way. If instead of like meticulously crafted funk jams, you just kind of had meandering folk rock. And so he's had multiple, like, since he pulled his stuff in 2022, he's released like 5 or 6 albums that I haven't listened to, some of which are albums that he recorded and was ready to release in 73 or 74 and just pulled, like full lost albums, which is kind of wild, like including one that he had, Tonight's the Night, which is like one a wild and very depressing album. Apparently he had like 2 albums on the same reel-to-reel tape and had a listening party just to decide which one he was going to release in 74, wild. Anyway, my love of Neil Young aside, he's got this really intense archival release project and constantly releasing new music. And, you know, one way to do that is to push one echelon of fans towards like the full deluxe CD box set in a kind of organized way. And that's another way to like, you know, just thinking about people paying money for music is that there is this development of fandom and the ability to intentionally cultivate fans. So, you know, you get some stuff on Spotify, but if you want the whole thing, you have to actually buy the album on whatever audio format is his preferred audio format, reel-to-reel tape or whatever. And that, that there's another way to segment listeners and fandoms. And that does feel like that's a place that folks are pushing towards generally. This idea that, in a kind of like standard business model way, honestly, is that like you cast a broad net to pull people in and then you like pull them up the pyramid scheme of buying deluxe Neil Young reissues, you know, in different colored vinyl. I mean, clearly the kings of this are the Grateful Dead, or the Grateful Dead organization, where they have. And it's really interesting, right? They who have never pulled anything off Spotify, but do these deluxe. So all the shows are released via live, you know, tapers have had them all, but they've got soundboard tapes for some shows that haven't circulated. So they're like carefully releasing those. And then they do this thing where they'll have release a 3 CD box set or 3 show box set and put one of those shows on Spotify. But the other 2 shows, you have to buy a limited edition box set to get access to them. You can get a lower quality audio one for free on the internet, but if you want the soundboard tape, you have to buy them. And the resale values for some of those are incredible because they make like 10,000 copies. And then completists want them all or whatever. And so, right, there's this whole ways to organize these businesses so that you can monetize the segments of your audience. But I mean, I think that there's something, we've talked about this before, and I do think that Neil Young is probably thinking about this. There's something kind of fundamentally anti-democratic about that, right? That only the people with the most money get access to the really good stuff.
Yeah, and I was also just thinking, it's interesting. We should also mention just in this conversation that Spotify did announce in 2021 that they were coming out with like a lossless high fidelity option.
Haven't done it.
Which still haven't done it. And even though as of like March of last year, we're telling, there was an article, I think in TechCrunch or something or maybe somewhere else where like a journalist inquired and they said they're still doing it. So as of a year ago, they said they're still doing it. But it is also interesting to note that also that Apple and Amazon basically started both giving customers high fidelity audio at like no extra cost, which probably is the reason why Spotify suddenly shelved it unofficially, unsure, because I was looking at a way to, of it being a way to make more money. But then now, like, you have these other platforms that are just offering it, which is also interesting too, because maybe that would suggest one of two things. One, that maybe these platforms don't see it as like a viable revenue stream to get some extra money, but also the fact that, as we mentioned before, like, Apple and Amazon aren't strictly like streaming platform audio companies and have like other ways of supporting the audio vertical, or whatever you want to call it, of their companies.
Right.
But, you know, it is also interesting too. I would say there is a sort of irony here where, like, you, that I don't, you say people don't care, and obviously that's like anecdotal. I mean, but it does seem like maybe people don't really care. And yet you're also seeing, like, and maybe this is once again going back to the urban elitist bubble, but you are seeing like a rise in like listening bars, you know, or like, you know, how do you explain like the increase in like vinyl, you know? I mean, maybe it's just like some sort of like, you know, commodified aesthetic sort of fetishism that's going on there as well. But it is interesting. And you're saying that, you know, that there is these sort of trends going on, and yet the assumption is that no one's actually cares about the quality, or they choose demand and ability to like, yeah. But the overall, I think, point that we're also trying to make, that maybe would be a good point to maybe start to segue into the second half of this, is once again going back to this point that I made earlier, in that fact of like the ubiquity of like the platforms and streaming, and how that just becoming like the dominant form. I mean, it is the dominant form to listen to music, and it's only becoming more solidified.
I mean, yeah, and I was actually kind of thinking through this, right? Because I was trying to think through, like, you know, Neil Young tries to negotiate the platform capitalism, whatever we want to call it, realizes that there's no real escape from the platforms, that, in fact, they're not fundamentally differentiated, and kind of folds is one way to look at this. And then I was thinking about whether this was actually different than how things worked before, right? So imagine that I own, it's 1975, and I own the Joe Rogan record store. And what I sell is Joe Rogan and Neil Young records, right? That's, for some reason, all I sell. There's no way that Neil Young cannot have me, can prevent me from selling his records. In 1975, Neil Young had no say in any way about, once his label, you know, had the complicated financial relationships with distributors that were then bought by record stores. Like, no one was tracking whether or not Neil Young's records appeared next to like Adolf Hitler's, right? There was no control over whose record, or the Monkees, or like whatever he hated at that time. There was no control. Neil Young had no control, once the record was sold, over where and how his music was being distributed, or being purchased next to, or being how it was being listened to. And so part of me was wondering, like, is there any fundamental difference here, right? He didn't have control then. He doesn't have control now. Artists make stuff for the market, and then they're just, it's out in there in the market. And, like, I guess I was trying to think about whether, and I'd be interested to hear your take about this. Clearly the difference, it seems to me, right, is the centralized nature, is the visibility of it, right? And the centralized nature of that visibility, that Neil Young is being sold by, basically, in, if we wanted to make Spotify in this analogy, is being sold in heavily in a store that also puts out records by someone he finds objectionable. I don't know if, right? And the fact is that the difference between then and now is that he can see it, and that it's all centralized. There's fewer different stores, and that there's not the kind of like dust your hands off-ness of the old system, where it's like, the records got sold after they're in the market, there's nothing I can do about them, right? now it's because it's this constant ongoing relationship that streaming enables, that instead of people buying a set of consumer goods and then owning them, they're constantly going back to the source. So there's this constant ongoing negotiated relationship between Neil Young and his listeners and the apps that allows that to be visible in a way that previously was invisible. But I don't know, like, is that just like he can see it now and it bothers him? Like, is it actually different, you think?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that he can see it, and so in a way that actually gives him like more power as well, that he can actually see, which is interesting. So he's like actually like the technology,
his eyes on it.
Yeah, and I should be clarifying, like, the technology itself like allows him to see it, not like Spotify specifically, but the technology itself, which is essentially also what he's in another argument criticizing, because yes, while we, you know, so there's like, it's kind of an odd thing. I think going back to like the 1975,
it's ironic, yeah.
Yeah, the 1975 like example is that, I mean, you could still see a situation where like whoever is like the distributor for, you know, Neil Rogan's record store, like, you know, maybe has a bad relationship with him and doesn't want to distribute like Neil Young's records there anymore. Or maybe Neil Young drives by and sees it in his tour van and is like, I don't want to be at that record store anymore. Like, people, there's three or four or five or maybe more record stores probably within like a, you know, 5 to 15 right. mile radius. And so there's also that it, there was like less consolidation of like access. So that's another thing. I think it also, to be honest with you, like, I mean, this isn't so much a critique of Neil Young, because I think probably the motives of Joni Mitchell and Neil Young are in the right place, but I think it also showcases, and this isn't ageist, but just a bygone era, where I think that there's a kind of protest that unfortunately I think just has like lost its teeth now in a way, which is really rooted in this sort of like consumerist protest that like vote with your dollar. And I just think that that's something that has continued to be passed down through Generation X and through like our generations and younger people, that in some way we can make some sort of like political or social change by not buying something or accessing something. And like, I think that it's not that it's completely toothless. I think like there are ways in which this does work, but I think that the reliance on that like kind of shows like a kind of a bygone era, in a sense that like this isn't going to, you know, like Joe Rogan issued an apology and then continued to record and make $250 million that year. Like, it didn't do anything. It didn't like stop people from getting on Reddit and like looking up, you know, other conspiracy theories about COVID, et cetera, et cetera. It just doesn't really, like, I think, work as well also, which, you know, I think also speaks to this platform issue as well, where there's, like, this just the fact that, like, everything's so much more consolidated now. There's so much more control. There's so much more, like, we have to. I mean, like, you don't have to get on the platform. You don't have to stream music. But like, you're in an extreme minority where like, and you, even then you're still responding to the dominant form and the dominant technology. So you're even basing your decisions off of that, that paradigm, which I don't know. I think it's just a couple things at play here, which I like, it just feels like a little bit of like, I mean, there's the irony that he's criticizing the very technology in which he is giving him access to be able to see and have this information. But then simultaneously, I think it's also like a kind of protest that I feel like, I don't want to call him out as it being disingenuous, but it does feel like a little bit, either it's done in like a sort of like a bygone era kind of way, or it's just a little bit done in bad faith, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the that's an interesting point. I mean, thinking about this kind of protest, like, I was thinking also about the last serious person who was not on Spotify, which was Taylor Swift. And that was kind of before,
by choice.
That was kind of before her Imperial era, actually. And Beyonce was not on Spotify for a while.
Right. Because of the whole Jay-Z title connection.
And so, like, I do think that some of this is just market power. It's like, I wonder if 2024 Taylor Swift coming off Spotify, what that would do.
But like, what would it do? We've talked about this. Like, what would it do? I mean, like, people.
I mean, I think if there was a major differentiation between these streaming services, it would really push people.
Push you to what? Just not. Like have like multiple like just go to the other. You mean like, or if she got off like all of streaming?
Well, if she got off on all streaming, I don't know what would happen. I don't think that's an option. But like, you could imagine pushing. Yeah, no, you're right. There's no escape from the streaming ecosystem. Right. I mean, and that's kind of maybe where the power happens. Like, I don't know if you can stop, and that's, and that kind of goes to his tech, his audiophile like quest, right? Like, there's no, yeah, I don't think there's a substantive way to escape this dreaming ecosystem. Similarly, I don't know if these like consumer boycotts function if you don't have. They clearly function really well if there's an easily another good that you can just choose, like a really depressing but very real thing. And I know some folks who work in the beverage industry, and it was like they were more freaked out about it than like the conservative Bud Light thing really damaged Bud Light. Like, it was real, and it's like depressing that that worked, but like it was actually like Bud Light's profits dropped in a significant way.
Is that right?
Similarly, yeah, that's my understanding.
Yeah, so yeah, so I guess it did decline. It was like there was like a 13% decline in third quarter sales, like right around this like this whole
look. That's depressing.
Kerfuffle.
That, I mean, with, no. I mean, it's horrible that that worked, but clearly it was a way to put pressure. And similarly, I think there's they weren't escaping light beer, right? Like, light beer sales didn't drop in America, but when you have options, you can play those options off each other. Conservatives can do it in the Bud Light case, and I think that you could play the streaming services off each other, but there's no escape from streaming, and I think that was what Neil found, right? His things are going to appear next to Joe Rogan, and there was nothing he could do about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. I mean, to kind of like also, though, I think also to my, so also to my point, though, I would also say I'd take your Bud Light example, and I would also raise it that like it didn't do anything socially or politically, and Anheuser-Busch is still like chugging along just fine. So if like your political social agenda is, and we don't even need to fucking mention it, but whatever the fucking insane right-wing bullshit it was that was pushing for this like boycott, it didn't actually do anything but just like dent the sales of Anheuser-Busch, but not really, considering that Anheuser-Busch made $59.38 right. billion, as I'm reading this article right now in CNBC. So once again, it's this idea that you're doing something. Like maybe the
yeah, that's
you know
that
maybe
point.
The but it's once again it doesn't you're not actually denting the GDP or like the gross profits of like a company or like anything like this, you know. And this is like something I kind of like I think came to a conclusion of I think like a long yeah. time ago that like, you know, I'm not about to like criticize anybody's, if you have a personal belief and you'd want to not buy a certain product because of like whatever thing you support, environmental, political, or otherwise, by all means fucking do exercise that, but also like don't think that like you're actually doing anything to damage that company or like in very rare cases are you doing that to the extent where you're actually making a political change. And I think it's actually, I'll just make this point, I think it's actually a problem that if you do want to do something political or social change, that this is oftentimes a fallback, that I'm going to then just not buy something and then it stays mm-hmm. there. When actually, like, you know, the real work around like whatever organization and all the other stuff that we don't need to get into considering the topics of our podcast, but like all the other stuff that actually the real work of political and social change like doesn't actually happen. Instead, you just decide that when you go to, you know, the Trader Joe's that you buy organic, and like great for you, like, buy organic, but like don't think that you're like suddenly, in fact you're actually probably just creating another market, like you know, you're helping Miller Lite or something like that, you know what I mean? Like, so yeah, but anyways,
so are you saying that we are all new?
Yeah, so like I think that we are all Neil Young in regards that we're all beholden to the streaming platforms and can't escape them. I mean, you can escape it, but they're there and artists are beholden to them at least. And yeah, I think this is further illustrated by what we're going to be talking about in the second half, which is the fact that UMG has been cooking, all right? And they're making all kinds of moves. I mean, and
Daddy
like,
Grange in the kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that we'll start with like actually one thing, which actually is not something UMG did, but is definitely something UMG pushed, which, you know, the last time we checked in on UMG in this podcast, we noted how Deezer and then also Spotify were instituting new rules regarding royalties. Just a little refresher, basically your royalties don't clock until you reach 1,000 plays and I think like 500 unique listeners. And so we also mentioned in the past that Deezer is partnering with UMG. And I guess in some ways I would say, I think it's fair, Sam, to say that Deezer seems to be the most recent kind of bellwether for the ways in which UMG wants to retool streaming. And funny enough, we saw some headlines very recently that Deezer has announced that they have deleted 26 million quote-unquote useless tracks since it recently launched an artist-centric model with UMG. The outgoing CEO said that there's a lot of content now getting uploaded to our platform every week and the numbers keep growing. And at a certain point, you get way too much content that is useless for the listeners and creating a bad user experience. Yada yada yada. They said they right now have over 200 million pieces of content on their platform. So that means that about 13% of it got deleted, which it's pretty wild. I would just say that like maybe this headline doesn't seem like that interesting, but I think the one thing that I think immediately stood out to me was the fact that now you have these CEOs and not now you have but you basically are beginning to see these CEOs and UMG really like wield its power in the sense of like they get to decide what's useless and what's not and what deserves royalties and what doesn't deserve royalties and like how many plays that determines and how many you know listeners that is, because I don't know, I mean I didn't see it, but I don't think it's probably too much of an assumption that there's probably some cute indie bands out there of some teenagers who had some music up and they got caught up in the net of useless tracks and were deleted off of Deezer. Which is like, I don't know, I think that like that kind of once again kind of goes against like this whole concept of like the accessibility to streaming and it also just sucks.
I think that this is like Deezer is this funny, you know, it's not one of the big major streaming platforms. It's a thing where sometimes stuff gets tried out on, it feels like. But I do think that this is like a broader part of a broader set of moves that UMG is making, where there's a new paradigm in town, right? And that paradigm is, it's not about individual streams. It's not about individual clicks. It's about relationships between artists and fans via platforms, I think, at a fundamental level. And we're going to talk about a couple other moves that UMG has made, but I do think that in some ways it's the flip side of what we were talking about in the first half of the episode. For artists, even artists as formidable as Mr. Young, there's no escape from the platforms. But in the face of a musical ecosystem in which the means of production are increasingly widely distributed through digital recording, and now potentially even non-human in the terms of AI, it turns out that that's actually fine, because they weren't selling music. They were selling acts that these companies have for quite some time been selling the relationship between artists and fans via platforms. And that pathway is the valuable thing. And so that it feels like they're doubling down. This feels like an example of by demonetizing some. And this happened with Deezer, the changes with Spotify and demonetization also went into effect on April 1st that you mentioned, that with the kind of demonetizing certain dreams and certain artists is kind of one side of the equation, and an equation where what you're trying to do is redefine the industry standard and what the industry is doing in a way that privileges, like you're saying, certain kinds of artists, certain kinds of relationships, and certain kinds of pathways. And I think it's really important because those pathways are less flexible, I think, than a lot of other parts of the industry might be. And it's possible to maintain a stranglehold on spaces, configurations of digital spaces in a way that it might not be possible to maintain a hold on audio files, for example.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like it's like selling like it's emphasizing the service for an artist aspect to it versus the service for like the listener aspect to it, which I guess like for like I guess like an up and coming nobody band, I guess it always kind of has had this like, well, like we have the ability to easily reach an audience because we're on Spotify or Deezer or whatever. But it seems to be like a turn towards like more of an emphasizing on that, that like if you like, listen, you might not make money off of us, but, you know, at least you're giving access to your listeners. And then you have the potential to possibly at some point make money off of us.
I mean, at some level, Saxon, is that any different than the initial value proposition of record labels?
Yeah, I mean, like indie record labels, maybe, I guess, as well.
Not just indie record labels, right? Like record labels, like at some
level. Yeah, but the thing
level,
is that like a record label is
record labels were always selling artist services.
Sure. Of course, yeah, for sure, I see that. But I mean, I guess in the difference is that, yeah, I guess maybe that's what you're referencing then with the demonetization thing, is that at least like you're getting a recording contract that at least comes with some sort of like advance, or at least like advance that goes towards recording music in a nice studio.
Right. No, this is a more platform version of it. I mean, I think once we're here, yeah, we should also, you know, another of these moves that UMG made, and there's, I think, about like two or three of them that we're going to be talking about, and maybe it's worthwhile to just kind of think about all of them together, is UMG announced a new partnership with Spotify. They're bringing music videos to Spotify as part of the initial salvo of a... I forget one of the music industry websites were like increasingly vague partner, you know, UMG and Spotify deliver a vague partnership, and it's like,
yeah, I read that too. Yeah,
no idea what this relationship is going to be like, but it sounds like music video is the first one, and like something about fan services, which I actually think that like I was saying is the flip side of this, right? Is on one side you're saying Spotify is no longer, it's not YouTube, right? It's not about anyone can upload whatever they want, and it feels like an open platform, because that's increasingly not working for the major labels as a massive wave of music has been released, though I actually think it's kind of bullshit. There's been more music released. Like, yes, there has been an increasing amount of music released for a long time. And I'm kind of... I think quoting friend of the pod David Turner here, but he's long been a skeptical of this for quite some time, because he's like, there's been more music released than anyone can listen to for like a decade and a half. What's different now? Like, is the rate of change really so important that, oh, now it's a crisis, but like 5 years ago when it was just a million bad rappers like also releasing records that no one was listening to, it was fine? And so I think that some of that is real. At the same time, you know, there was this like decreasing, major labels have a decreasing percentage of total streams, as like the long tail does pick up real weight. But yeah, no, I mean, it feels like they're trying to redefine what these services, what these platforms, at least Spotify, is for, and in some ways put it away from this marketplace version towards a set of relationships, like I was saying, between artists and fans. And that's, I think, where the third piece, and this kind of put all the pieces on the table, the third interesting partnership that they've developed, which is this 10-year long partnership with Hybe. CEO of Hybe America, friend of the pod, Scooter Braun. Which I believe puts Scooter and Taylor back on the same team once again. No word about the potential like geopolitical ramifications of that. My guess is that it's not going to get brought up because it's now big business and inconvenient for everyone. But basically, Hybe is music company, ostensibly, really like I would call them a multiverse company, basically. Hybe is the K-pop multiverse company that launched BTS, but has since really dug into basically creating web fan platforms and bringing and define using that to define K-pop as an international phenomena. And we've said this before and talked about this with also a friend of the pod, Kara. We've got a lot of friends of the pod mentioned in this episode.
Some real, some not. I mean, maybe referring to you saying Scooter was his friend of the pod, but anyways.
the sense that K-pop, K-pop's ability to create, as an industry's ability to create multimedia fan, not just fan experiences, but spaces of fandom that are controlled by the industry is like the best thing since sliced bread. That's the future, I think, that these companies want. And I see the kinds of relationships that they're developing, a company like UMG is developing with a company like Spotify, as kind of laying some of the groundwork for that. Because in some ways, that's a way to maintain control. You can't control the product. You haven't been able to control the product since Napster at some level, right? You could control the creation of the product, but you couldn't control how it's distributed once you could copy MP3s. Increasingly, as social media develops, you can't control the creation of the product, right? Between AI and cheap AI assistant tools and just the distribution of the ability to make music and social media, you know, eating away at the centrality of the kind of media outlets, you know, the gatekeepers. This is like the oldest story of the internet. It's much more destabilized and much less clear. What you can do is have control of where people gather, where people watch the music videos, where people listen to the music, where people interact with each other as fans. You can control the platforms. And the thing is, that's the one thing that you really can't copy, right? Like, you can't bootleg a million BTS fans interacting. There's going to be a couple of places where that happens. And if you own those places, you can make money from them. It reminds me a little bit of, and this is, you know, me being really out of pocket here, but one of the interesting things that's occurred with the video game industry, right, is the way it's not eliminated piracy, but deeply challenged it by making all of the games multiplayer. Because you can copy a video game that's single player, but not all the video games are multiplayer, clearly, but like having at least multiplayer components. But if a central part of the game is interacting with other people online, you can control the places where people can interact online, because that's infrastructure, and infrastructure, it turns out, is pretty, someone needs to maintain it. It's got costs associated with it, and that by building games around that, it makes piracy more difficult. And I'm sure that there are ways you can hack onto like Dark Souls 3's online components, but like it's much more difficult. And I think that that's a model that, in the wake of a set of changes for the music industry that are coming, that these companies want to maintain, right? They want music videos on Spotify. They want fan services on Spotify. They want to create fan services. They want to create closed gardens of fans. And they want to basically make all the Barbs or all the Swifties.
So you're saying that like they see like maybe like a platform like Deezer or Spotify who's willing to like maybe get even cozier with they being UMG, like UMG sees like Deezer or Spotify continually getting cozy with them as like possible spaces for that.
Yeah. Or that if they're, you know, one of the interesting things is that the Hybe has this thing called the Weavers, which is basically a centralized app for fandoms. And it's been launched since 2019. My understanding is a lot of people have a lot of problems with it. It doesn't work super well. But like, instead of saying like, oh, everyone's going to interact, and this is where like the elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned yet, which is UMG's continued battle with TikTok, that UMG's music is still not on TikTok. And in some ways you could say like the future they're fighting against is on one side AI and on the other side TikTok. And what they don't want is this giant freewheeling non-music exclusive platform that is the definitive space where communities for music are being created and developed. What they want is a closed garden where all the fans come together to interact with music and have to pay to get into the fan club, to pay to get to the things, really to make people pay for the experience of being a Taylor Swift fan or a Beyonce fan in order to get access to the highest echelons of fan materials. And you could argue that one of the ways you do that is by making sure that there are things you can't get elsewhere, and that a lot of that stuff will be music specific or music exclusive, and a lot of that stuff. So yeah, like you're saying, Spotify is a decent place to start building out that infrastructure.
Yeah, for sure. And then on the other front, which you mentioned, when it comes to like AI, this is not as, I think, of a big deal, but nonetheless, it does reflect like where the people of the executive suite at UMG, where their minds are, where they also, and like I said, UMG's been cooking, announced like a partnership with Roland.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And they put, and in a very like bizarre, disgustingly corporate move, published a joint manifesto. I mean, if you want to talk about,
I love the way when companies publish, even more, it's like they publish manifestos. I'm waiting for the company zine.
Yeah, I know. No, they're basically company pitchforks, basically. I always forget about that. There's actually like music websites that are actually like basically written and sponsored by UMG, but they look like Pitchfork or something. It's very strange. And you also want to talk about using the term manifesto. I just love it how like you want to talk about like capitalism and like corporations like just like gobbling up like any kind of like aesthetic or terminology, like utilize it any kind of like quote unquote like revolutionary or like progressive like way for their benefit. Hello, here we go. So Roland and UMG's manifesto is called Principles for Music Creation with AI, which, you know, I don't really need to read them through, but, you know, it's basically
like... Hit us with
like,
some good ones. Hit us with some of the good ones.
Let's see here. We believe that, that human-created works must be respected and protected. We believe that transparency is essential to responsible and trustworthy AI. We're proud to help bring music to life, which is an interesting one. Basically, you know, this is all just a sort of like soft shot over the bow to basically say that, like, to try to encourage reining in AI, I guess, or something like their benefit, I guess. I don't know.
I'm thinking though, you know, about...
If we're thinking about control, if we're thinking about control and we're thinking about like these sort of closing gardens and what you're saying, mm-hmm. like obviously like AI is, as we've illustrated on many episodes, it's coming, it's here, whatever. And like, you know, it's a worry of UMG and it's a worry of these streaming platforms. And like, this is like kind of like just at least expresses like UMG and I guess Roland as well, like their desire for like having some sort of say or control over that sort of the latest AI technology.
Well, I was just thinking about this in terms of what you were saying at the end of the last half of the episode about the kind of inadequacy of consumer activity, because I do think that one thing that's interesting about all of this, this set of negotiations seems more about TikTok and the battles around TikTok in the immediate present, and gosh, if UMG manages to like really dent TikTok, that will be a truly impressive display of IP muscle. But yeah, just thinking about the inadequacy of consumer boycotts. And I've started to see this on like various social media platforms where like someone, there's an AI generated image going around and people are like, don't do that. Like, it's gross. It's weird. Especially when they're making ideological points with it. Like, stop pretending this is real. Like, you're putting artists out of work. Like, you do better. There was a interesting column, like, the monthly like metal column in The Quietus starts with this like long discussion about like the expansion of AI into heavy metal images that some bands are like using AI and they're pissed off it. And I think that like some of this is real, and I do think that there's like an uncanny valley thing. And certainly like once you get attuned to bad AI, like you start being like, ugh, when you see one of those images, though. the flip side is they're going to get better and better and better. Like that's how this technology has been working.
Right.
There's been, we've talked about this before. It's really annoying when people are like, oh, the like AI images are never going to be good. Like, look at this image. And it's like, did you see it 2 years ago? Like the progression is wild. Like,
yeah, or like 5 years ago.
But I just don't think that these like kind of consumer boycotts of AI produced things are gonna work, like you're saying. And so the question is, like, these companies, like, you don't want to put your faith in them, but this is gonna be how it gets decided, not by consumers like holding hands singing Kumbaya and being like, we want human produced goods. Like, look at how our iPhones are made, despite all of our like various folks' liberal protestations, right? It's gonna be these companies. And the question is, like, is there any way to like have it be in their interests to not have it be all AI? And it's weird to be like the UMG fan created thing as like, at least it's all human, but like, geez, at least it's all human. It's not my vision of the like a world I'd want to live in, but like the AI-drenched TikTok is also not a vision of the world I want to live in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we're going to leave it on that slightly like dystopian note. But this, like, I think that, because I think you really summarize like the overall like thinking, which is like, yeah, like this is where these decisions are going to be made. And maybe consider that if you're also trying to consider about alternative ways of either subverting it or maybe changing the trajectory of it. These are things that we have to consider, that we are all Neil Young. So make sure to buy some Neil Young live tickets. And we'll catch you again in a very short time. Music by Bird Language. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you soon. Bye.